Welcome to The Lover's Hole, a Patrick O'Brien podcast. You are with Mike.
And Ian.
And we are rereading our favorite books, the Aubrey Matron canon of Patrick O'Brien. Ian, we said we'd ratchet it up a good bit last chapter. Are we in for even a little bit more this week?
I think we are, Mike. I think we are. Let's take a look at last time. Last time, Jack had delayed his convoy. He had re-rigged the Polycrest. He had saved a crew member from drowning. And meanwhile, Stephen had been displaying his deadly dueling skills. For reasons that we'll come back to. They had chased this privateer, the Bellone, left behind two prizes untaken, and finally caused the Bellone to be wrecked on the coast, but had disappointed Admiral Hart for the want of prize money once again. Hart had ordered Jack to the Baltics, that's punishment for you, and Stephen had received a sealed envelope, forsooth, from the Admiralty. Right. This time, Mike, this is one of the big, big chapters in the canon. Stephen gets to see Diana and Sophie before he departs on his own secret mission. Jack returns from the Baltics. Heneage Dundas asks Stephen to deliver a warning to Jack. And things get really bad, only for them to get even worse.
Oh, man. Ouch. Thank you, Ian. Gosh. Well, they start off seemingly innocently with Stephen and Diana riding in a post chase, eating bread and butter. How lovely. And Stephen is extolling the wonders of DuPont that they've seen, you know, stop, which you pointed out, Ian, is a callback all the way back to chapter one when he said he was with child to see a DuPont.
Right.
And DuPont's real man-made constructions to aid the supply of water to livestock and making a big comeback now with this whole age of climate change.
Right. Yeah. Just a place for rearing of frogs and other aquatic life as well.
That's exactly right. Well, Diana is going on pleasantly about how much she's looking forward to Brighton and how much she longs to see the pavilion. And she hopes she'll be as pleased with it as Stephen is with his DuPonts. Stephen replies, and O'Brien writes, "Was not candor the soul of friendship, I should say, why Villars? I'm sure it will delight you, affecting not to know that you were there last week." Diana becomes very defensive, but then asks, "Well, is that publicly known?" Stephen says, "It is." And Jack is very concerned. He thinks Brighton is dissolute, full of male and female rakes, and he doesn't like the Prince of Wales and his set there. Mm-hmm. Diana asks, "What's happened to Jack's gaiety and fun and laughter?" She hopes Stephen will tell him to stop preaching and moralizing. Stephen says that he's sorry to say that he and Jack are no longer on the terms that he could say anything like that to him, especially since last Sunday's dinner.
Damn, we missed another dinner.
Ugh. Yeah. Come on, O'Brien. You keep, we keep missing this. Diana thought it was a very successful dinner. She'd been very careful with the pudding. She asked, you know, if Jack said anything specific. Stephen said, "Well, he did make some illiberal flings at Jews in general." And Diana says, "Oh, that's why he was so glum. I see." Stephen says, "Diana, you're not a fool. You know, you made your preference very well marked." Diana says, "Canning was the stranger, and Jack and Stephen were the old friends, so Canning had to sit beside her and be attended to." Yeah. And Diana says, "Wait, Stephen, what's the name of that bird?" And Stephen says, "That's a wheatear. We've seen about 200 or 300 since we left, and I've told you its name three times now." It seems like, you know, you keep doing this to change the conversation. But then Stephen stops to look at another DuPont. And when he comes back, Diana asks if she can ask him what that delightful smell is without being abused again. And Stephen says, "It's time, mother of time, being crushed under our carriage wheels." And I thought, oh, man. That sounds like a little ominous.
A little ominous portent there. Plus, maybe it's a bit of a pun as well, like murdering time, like we're wasting time.
Oh, good point, Ian. Good point. I think I'm just tense going into this tense chapter.
Right. I think we're all a little on edge here. Diana tries to steer the topic of conversation onto Jack Aubrey and his voyage to the Baltic. And Stephen says, well, this is all very well, but I wish I could go and see a narwhal. That would be his main excitement, there, getting to go into the to these northern shores. And Diana asks, well, where are you going then? And we get told how Stephen is tempted to succumb to the classical temptation of the secret agent in his loneliness, the temptation that he's never felt before to tell her, in fact, that he's going to be landed on the coast of Spain at the dark of the moon. Now, Mike, there are two different ways of looking at this. And I was looking at this thinking, ah, he's never felt it before. That's maybe a small point in the column for those who think, ah, Stephen Maturin probably wasn't a spy before the events of Post Captain. But on the other hand, Mike, you could look at it in another way, right?
Yeah, yeah. I was kind of thinking it that it might mean that no matter how long he's been an intelligence agent and how much he's cared for someone else before, like his dream back to Ireland, he's never been tempted to break confidentiality before. Or as I would say it in modern parlance, he's never had it this bad before.
He has. Very true. He has never had it this bad before. Good point. Well, he's got this cover story that he shares now with Diana. He says, I have some law business. I need to go to Plymouth and then to Ireland. And Diana wonders why he'd offer to give her a lift when this is so far out of his way. And he covers for that a little bit by saying, well, I wanted to see these dew ponds and the wheat ears, and of course enjoy the pleasure of driving over grass. None of which have anything to do with her, and he's very obviously dodging it. And she spots this in a second. What a dogged brute you are, Maturin, upon my honour. I shall lay out for no more compliments. No, but in all sadness, said Stephen, I like sitting in a chase with you, above all when you're like this. I wish this road might go on forever. There was a pause, and the chaise was filled with waiting, but he did not go on. And after a moment, she said with a forced laugh, ah, well done, Maturin. You are quite a courtier, but I am afraid I can see its end already. There is the sea, and this must be the beginning of the devil's punch bowl. And once again, Mike, you've talked about this being awkward and on edge. That's a brilliant awkwardness writing just there. And real candor from Stephen to Diana about how much he enjoys her company, but dressed up in what she, I think, rightly describes as a rather dogged delivery. So here we are, passing the time in this chase, and Diana explains where she's headed for next. She says she's going to stay at Lazy Jerseys. Stephen thinks that she is the mistress of the Prince of Wales and that he knows that Canning is a member of this set. And Diana puts a few more specific facts about Lady Jersey in front of him. She is, says Diana, a Villiers cousin by marriage. There's nothing to the vulgar newspaper reports that Lady Jersey is the Prince of Wales' mistress. And she and the Prince of Wales like each other, and Mrs. Fitzherbert is devoted to her. We'll come to Mrs. Fitzherbert again in a second. Stephen says that for his part, he knows nothing of these things. He says, let me tell you about poor MacDonald's arm. And I'm going, wait, what happened to MacDonald's arm again? We'll have to pick that up. And they part at Lady Jersey's door with tension and artificial smiles. Yeah, that they and us both. So, Mike, I think in another book of the canon, we had talked a bit about the extramarital proclivities of the Duke of Cumberland, who was to become William IV. But here we're talking about the Prince of Wales right now, who is in due course to become George IV. Tell us about Mrs. Fitzherbert and Lady Jersey and how that all was working in real life.
Yeah, this is an interesting triangle here, this Lady Jersey, Mrs. Fitzherbert, and the Prince of Wales. Let's start with Lady Jersey. Frances Twisden was a Countess of Jersey, the wife of George Villiers, 4th Earl of Jersey. She lived 1753 to 1821. She was a leading hostess associated with that fast set and popular gossip. Some historians say probably ill-founded. Others wonder, had her as the regent's mistress, the regent being the Prince of Wales. So perhaps, according to a lot of historians, Diana was right. It's all just gossip here. Mrs. Fitzherbert, Marie Anna Fitzherbert, 1765 to 1837, was a Roman Catholic already twice married and widowed in very quick succession, was the very longtime companion of the Prince of Wales. Ah, our other member of this thing later, as it is King George IV. He was regent for his father, George III. But Prince of Wales and Mistress Harpers were actually married secretly and against the law, as they both knew, in a ceremony at her home in 1785. Now, from pretty much that point on, she was treated and received in society as his legal wife, even by the royal family, except for George III, who had no time for a son or anyone in that circle. We know George III had his own issues for the rest of her life. But that marriage, however, by an act of parliament, was later declared invalid in 1794 because it did not have George III's or the Privy Council's consent, which was required back then, and because by law, the heir could not marry a Catholic. So it was kind of all of a sudden legally off again. The Prince of Wales, later George IV, marries a cousin. It's all wrapped up in what he had to do to get his inheritance, to not lose his heir to the throne. However, that marriage lasted a very, very short time. And the relationship between the Prince of Wales and Mrs. Fitzherbert went back and forth. And finally, in 1830, when George IV was dying, he asked to be buried with her eye miniature around his neck. Now, this is not her actual eye, but a custom of that time was to have a beautiful small painting of your beloved's eye that you wore around your neck. And his wish was granted. He was buried with Mrs. Fitzherbert's eye miniature around his neck.
Wow. So that's the world that Diana was in. Stephen Maturin's headed to a world that's a bit more prosaic and naval, right?
Right. Well, Stephen stops to see Sophie, who, with her sister, is staying at Admiral Haddock's place in Plymouth for the summer there. Sophie thinks that the waiting sea officer announced by the butler, had arrived in a postchaise, is wearing a cloak, might be Jack, and she's running to the library. Stephen sees her running through one of the windows he's sitting in. She bursts through the door, and the text says, with hardly a pause, says what a delightful surprise it is to see him. She thought he was in the Baltic. Yeah, she also thought he was Jack. But she asks if Stephen's heard the splendid news. The Patriotic Fund has awarded Captain Aubrey a sword of 100 guineas, and the merchants awarded him a piece of plate for destroying the Boulogne. She wonders if he'll be made post. And Stephen says, well, not for a letter of marque, especially since old Jarvey did not build any ships, but he made a ton of post captains.
Ah, very good. So Sophie's clearly delighted. She thinks this is like the beginning of a new chapter for Jack. And I think Stephen is not so sure. I think he's got a bit more of a realistic perspective here. And he goes on to tell Sophie that Diana is in Brighton with Lady Jersey, as we know. Sophie's never heard of Lady Jersey and has got no knowledge of this kind of intrigue and kind of slightly outrageous driven behavior of this set of people. And he goes on then to talk about Jack, how Jack is unhappy, how the Polycrest is a miserable vessel, how Admiral Hart is a scrub. Jack has a great many worries ashore and afloat. And he adds that Jack is as jealous of Stephen as Stephen is of him. And in another one of these very intimate, quite kind of confessional conversations between Stephen and Sophie, he lays it out for her. He says, I love him as much as I have loved any man, but often these last months, I have wondered whether we can stay in the same ship without fighting. He's no longer a comfort to him. He says he's just an irritation and a constraint. Their friendship is constrained. There's great tension with everybody being cooped up on a small ship. Too many opportunities, he says, for misunderstanding. And he thinks that if they continue to serve in the Downs, the friendship can't last. And this is very, very disheartening. I think it's entirely true. I think he's got a pretty clear insight into what's going on with Jack here. And Sophie's reply is that, well, surely Jack loves you dearly. And she wonders if Jack knows about Stephen's feelings for Diana. And Stephen, for his part, says he thinks Jack would never have crossed with him over Diana if it was not for a series of unhappy misunderstandings. And we remember those at Queenie's party and all the various other goings on. And he says Jack is not very quick in these kinds of matters, and he doesn't really know Stephen's feelings. Not very many people do. Now, after silently drinking coffee, Stephen tries almost agonizingly to say, well, why, we could all put this right. He says, a man is helpless against a direct attack by a woman. He's taking words from the mouth of Diana Villiers just a few chapters ago. He's hopeless against a plain statement of affection. And Sophie can see what he's suggesting here. Stephen's suggesting that Sophie communicate directly with Jack and say that she is his. No, 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 says Sophie. I could not write to him again. She says it would be terribly forward. Stephen suggests, well, maybe if the Polycrest were to put in close by through this coming summer, Sophie could ask the Admiral to take her down to the Downs. It could be very conducive to an understanding. Sophie thinks this is terrible. It would be too pushy. She said also that she would die if Jack refused her. So just like the men in the story, she's got an aversion to making an offer and then being rebuffed. Stephen says, if she had seen Jack's tears over the kindness, over the hampers of food, she would not be concerned about a refusal. Ah, I mean, we'll come to this in a second, Mike. I think this is too little too late, but it's really agonizing that Stephen can see how close they are to a solution here.
It is, and it goes both ways. You know, Stephen goes on saying there's much to be said for directness. Yeah. So Sophie picks up that mantle and says, well, you know, can I say something to you that might be improper or wrong? And he says, well, I would take that as being very friendly of you. And she suggests that he propose marriage to Diana. And might that make them all happy? Adding that she's certain that that's what Diana expects. And Stephen reels back. He says, you know, I'm no kind of match for her. I'm just a little ugly man with no name or fortune. And he reminds Sophie of Diana's pride, her ambition, her connections.
Yeah.
Sophie says Stephen thinks far too little of himself. She says he's as good looking as Captain Aubrey. Everybody says so. And he has a castle. Stephen says, you know, a castle in Spain is not a castle in Kent. He says, my castle is mostly ruined. The sheep shelter under the part that still has a roof. And the lands he owns only bring in 200 to 300 English pounds a year. And Sophie says, well, that's plenty enough to live on. And if Diana loves you just a little bit, and Sophie thinks any woman would love Stephen at least a little bit, you know, that Diana would be delighted by his offer. Well, Stephen, like Sophie, is, you know, kind of not seeing it exactly the way Sophie is here.
No, no, despite all this me castle, less Sue castle business, it's not quite going to work out like that, is it? Stephen says that Sophie is blinded by her partiality. And he means that as a compliment to her, that she's got a very particular and very, you know, honorable view of the situation. And as for love, he says, love, that amiable, unmeaning word, however you may define it, I do not believe that she, that's Diana, that she knows what it is. As you told me once yourself, affection, kindness, friendship, good nature sometimes, yes. Beyond that, nothing.
Mm.
As Stephen says, that he's going to have to wait it out. He'll wait indefinitely. He's content to be what I think the French would call a pis-aller, for the want of nothing better, kind of offering. He doesn't want to risk, for his side, a direct, contemptuous refusal. Sophie asks what this pis-aller thing means. What one accepts, he says, when one can do no better. And here's the real stinger. It is my only hope.
Wow. Oh,
talk about unrequited. Ah,
wow.
Again, Sophie's trying to build him back up. You're far too humble, she says. He says, well, I'm a papist. So what, says Sophie? Mrs. Fitzherbert is a Catholic. And Stephen says it's odd that Sophie should mention her. That's the conversation that he had with Diana rather than with Sophie. Anyway, fascinating that they're kind of fencing around, trying to build each other up and also feeling a little bit pessimistic about their situations as well. Stephen wraps this up, asking after Sophie's family, asking after this suitor, Mr. Bowles. And I love Sophie's comeback on Mr. Bowles here. Sophie says, with a flash in her eyes, he got impertinent and I sent him on his way after telling him that her affections were engaged elsewhere. And even though Mr. Bowles thought that this was a wrong thing without her mother's consent, Sophie is having none of this. And Mike, this whole thing, like I said, makes me think, if you all had been able to be this direct with each other and kind of candid about things a few chapters ago, we might not be here. But we're all kind of dancing around our fear of affront and our fear of the kind of social norms. And it's just agonizing.
Right. Right. Oh, I do hate it. Well, O'Brien gives us a little bit of relief here. He writes these beautiful paragraphs that are almost stream of consciousness, where he's essentially summing up these many weeks or months of Stephen's travels through Spain on his intelligence mission. He travels through the mountains. He meets with the Lord Abbot of Montserrat. And I'll put just a hint of the text in here, but by all means, if you haven't read this recently, go back. I love this. The endless white road winding, the inhuman landscape of Aragon, cruel sun and weariness, dust, weariness to the heart, and doubt. What was independence but a word? What did any form of government matter? Freedom to do what? Disgust, so strong that he leaned against the saddle, hardly able to bring himself to mount. My mind is too confused for anything but direct action, he said. The flight, disguised as an advance. I thought, God, not only the descriptions are beautiful, but his state of mind and the way, you know, O'Brien is just like, it's almost like it's bleeding from his life here the page. You know, the flight disguised as an advance, fleeing from what? From Diana, advancing towards what? Catalan independence? I don't know, but I just love this passage, the whole section here.
Right. And it's written very beautifully. It's going to come back to haunt Stephen in this chapter, as we're going to see. The journey goes on. He returns to Ireland, which is where he had departed from, surrounded by old memories. And remember, Stephen's got a memory of an unhappy love affair back home in Ireland. If I could just throw off some of this burden of memory, he said to his second glass of laudanum, I should be more nearly sane. Here's to you, Villiers, my dear. And he's drinking down his laudanum. Whoa. He takes the mail coach, 275 jerking miles back to London, and works on his report. And as the text says, he's trying to disentangle the strands of altruism, silliness, mere enthusiasm, self-seeking, love of violence, personal resentment, trying to give the impossible plain answer to the question, is Spain going to join France against us? And if so, when? And there's a huge amount of action and a huge amount of, you know, story arc for Stephen Maturin tied up in those few paragraphs. Really masterfully done. And now we're kind of caught back up and we return to something more like normal time as we're with Stephen as he returns to Deal and he's sitting, drinking tea and eating a muffin in the Rose and Crown, watching the shipping out there in the Downs. And he notices as he's in this environment that all these little reattachments to naval life start to kind of click in all around him. He reflects that back in London, he had been very well received at the Admiralty, praised by a gentleman from the Foreign Office who'd been called in. And Lord Melville, the first Sea Lord, had repeatedly mentioned the Admiralty's sense of obligation to him, saying that any request he chose to make would receive the most earnest and sympathetic consideration, which is quite the thing, because we know how carefully Lord Melville minds the handing out of his favours. And speaking of the Melville family, he sees Heneage Dundas. There's this very comical thing of seeing Heneage's nose pressed against the window looking like a snail. But anyway, maybe that's just to bring us right up to date that we're first person kind of in real time with Stephen. It's a lovely little touch. Heneage steps in. He joins Stephen and says, I've been looking for you for months every time the Polycrest was in, but I'd heard you were on leave. And Heneage, with a little bit of foreshadowing here, notices that Stephen has gone pretty brown and says, where have you been? Attending to tedious family business in Ireland, says Stephen. Well, laughs Dundas, I would have sworn you'd been in the med with that tan. And they chat for a while, and Dundas gets quiet, looking like he has something important on his mind, but he doesn't know quite how to say it.
Yeah. And he finally says that he understands that Dr. Maturin has a particular kindness for Jack Aubrey. Stephen says, sure, you know, I have a great liking for him. Dundas says he does too. You know, he said, we've served together even before we were midshipmen, but Aubrey just won't listen to him. Perhaps it's because, you know, he's always been junior to Aubrey. And of course, now he's a post-captain and Aubrey is not. He doesn't say that part. But he hopes that Stephen could hint to Aubrey that he is, and the text says, I will not say ruining his career, but sailing very close to the wind. Heneage goes on to explain he's not clearing his convoys. Talk puts him in the Downs when he doesn't have to be there, and people have a pretty good notion of why. And then he emphasizes it won't answer, not in Whitehall. So Stephen says, well, you know, I thought lingering in port is a practice not unknown to the Navy. And Stephen is referring back to some pretty famous people here who had similar behavior.
Nelson.
We'll come back to them again. Hendon says, well, if you're an admiral with a couple of fleet actions and a peerage, it's not unknown, but it is unknown for a commander. And he begs Matron to tell Aubrey that it will not do. And Stephen thanks Dundas, who, it, as you mentioned, is related to the First Lord. So Dundas has got a pretty good ear into the Admiralty here. And the fact that he's been trying to find Stephen for months after Jack won't listen to him says he thinks this is really important. Well, Stephen thanks him for his mark of confidence, you know, coming, bringing this to me. And he says, I'll do what I can. As a matter of fact, I'm going to go get a boat now and head out to meet the Polycrest. So he's not going to wait. He's going to go do this as quickly as he can.
Right. And with a tiny bit of a look ahead, I wish he hadn't been in quite so much haste. But anyhow, here we go. This does seem like a good solution, right? This seems like it's perfectly sensible advice from Hennage. It's a perfectly reasonable thing for a friend to do for another friend. Back aboard the Polycrest then. Stephen immediately sees how much worse the situation has got. I mean, worse in terms of the cohesion of the crew and the atmosphere on board. All of them are on deck to moor, and he sees that it's a sullen set of men that are being driven here. They're not a willing crew, even less so than they were when he was last there. Parker, the first lieutenant, seems to be deranged. He's barking orders. He's handing out threats and insults and kicks and blows. The replacement for MacDonald, who realize that we've lost touch with it a little bit here. But anyhow, MacDonald's replacement, the new Marine lieutenant, is even worse than Parker. And he's shouting at his soldiers, bouncing about with his stick, and just what you don't want on an ill-tempered ship where the Marines are partly there as security for the captain. You don't want an ill-tempered, mistreated Marines guarding you because they hate their lieutenant. So this is a really, really grim situation. This is an impression that is confirmed when Stephen visits the sick berth. There is an assistant there sent by the Admiralty. He's not very wise, not very skilled, not unkind. Yet all the patients never smile. They give short answers. There's none of the interchange or the friendliness that Stephen would have expected, except for from one old Sophie, and even he is uneasy and inhibited. So we've got awkward, tricky conversations ashore, and we've got that same awkwardness in conversations here aboard ship. And when Stephen's mate points at this patient's head to say something about an injury to the head, the patient instantly raises an arm up to protect himself from a blow, which is a real giveaway that there's been some brutality here. So all is not well as Stephen finds himself back aboard the Polycrest, Mike.
No. As it rolls on, Jack has gone off to make his report. Parker continues barking orders until the square course and topsails are furled in a body smooth enough for a royal review. So we remember this ridiculous comment that Hart made that Jack says, yeah, nobody does that. Well, now they're doing it apparently every time. Stephen walks into the gunroom, and there's that Marine officer again reclining on two chairs with his feet on the table. And he seems very jovial and familiar having met Stephen before. He says, oh, you know, you must be the Sawbones returned. I'm Smithers. Forgive me for not getting up because I'm fagged out from mooring the ship. And Stephen says, yeah, he saw Smithers. He seemed to be very active. And Smithers says, well, I like my men to know who's who and what's what and to move smart or they'll smart if you get my meaning. Ha, ha, ha.
Yeah,
well. He says, I hear you play the cello. We must play together one night. I played the German flute. I was the best player at Eton in my class. I'd be making twice what, you know, I'm being paid for fighting in His Majesty's War if I did it professionally. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh. here we go. Our first flute playing Marine officer in the cannon who's just a real, not to our cup of tea. But then it gets a little worse. He asks if Stephen finds the ship as slow as he does. Nobody to talk to, meaning he's above them all. Only Halfpenny Whist. And asks Stephen, yeah, should you like to play hands of cards? Stephen says, well, you know, I don't play much. And has the captain returned? Smithers says, oh, he won't be back for hours. Don't worry. He's pulling against the tide to Dover to a luscious piece he has over there. And, you know, if he wasn't the captain, Smithers says, I would be cutting him out. You don't know the effect this red coat has on women. She had invited all the officers last week and looked at him. And Stephen cuts him off, saying, you cannot be speaking of Mrs. Villiers, sir. Oh, a pretty young widow? Yes. Do you know her? Yes, sir. And I should be sorry to hear her spoken of with disrespect. Oh, well, if she's a friend of yours, cried Smither with a knowing leer, that's different. I have said nothing. Mum's word. Now, what about our game? And Ian, there's even more going on here than just, you know, the disgust that I feel listening to this conversation. Put this in context of the times for us.
Yeah, it's really interesting. This phrase of being under protection, I think, we don't know for sure, but I think it's a hark back to part of the dueling code. Smithers is effectively asking whether Diana is under Stephen's protection. And remember that phrase. Jack's going to use it in a few pages' time. And it has a particular significance. The code of dueling between gentlemen, known as the Code Duello, has a list of articles. And Article 10 says that any insult to a lady under a gentleman's care or protection is to be considered as, by one degree, a greater offence than if given to the gentleman personally.
Whoa.
So it could be here that that phrase sort of dangles in the air, and Stephen is warning Smithers that he's ready to fight to wipe out any offence committed against Diana. And I certainly take this whole conversation and the scene with Smithers here as an escalation of Stephen's determination to, you know, to use violence. I think Stephen knows, at least subconsciously, what's coming in this chapter. And I think it was no coincidence as well that he took the time in the previous chapter, in with the help of MacDonald, to polish his fighting skills. So this has got a real dark resonance for me here.
Well, and it also seems, Ian, like Smithers has become a lightning rod for Stephen's emotions right now.
Yeah, absolutely. So Stephen asks if Smithers plays well, meaning plays cards. Smithers is very confident. I was born with a pack of cards in my hand. And Stephen decides to up the ante. Oh, he says, I never play for small stakes. That's boring. Smithers says, I'm not afraid. He rattles off all the impressive places that he's played and with whom he's played. And Stephen is asked what he thinks of that. And just before they're about to turn to the game of cards, the other officers come down into the gun room. They silently watch them play now until Stephen has beaten Smithers very severely. And Pullings says, ha ha ha, you picked a wrong one when you tackled the doctor. And I say, ha ha ha, Pullings, you don't know how right you are. Smithers is very willing to put Pullings down here. He says, be quiet, gentlemen are playing cards. By the way, I don't like your pipe smoking, which is a classist sort of snobbish dig at Pullings. And Stephen tells Smithers how much he owes, and it's a large amount of money. Smithers says, I supposed that you would take my note of hand. And Stephen says, well, we agreed to play for cash, so it's on you now. They hear the captain is coming aboard, but he's coming portside, so he's coming kind of semi-incognito, so they don't have to jump up straight away. Stephen says, I do need to leave in any case. Thank you for the game. And Smithers tries to protest that this is ungentlemanly to step away from the table when you're so far ahead. On the contrary, says Stephen, that's the very best moment to leave. Stephen says that if Smithers feels that way, then once he's been to get the gold that he already owes to Stephen, he can cut to double or quits, that is to say, to double the amount that he owes to Stephen or to write it off. Sans revanche is the phrase that he uses, meaning no revenge, like this is it, no returns. Smithers comes back, lays down 2.5 rolls of guineas. This is a very large sum of money. Stephen very bluntly says, ace is high. He's looking at his watch. He's impatient and says, please cut. And guess what? They cut the deck. Stephen wins again, and Smithers now owes double. He's definitely going to have to give his note of hand, which is a very uncomfortable thing for a gentleman playing cards to have to do. Well, as you said, this is our first German flute-playing marine officer. We're destined to dislike these people for all of their bad habits and their personal airs and their entitlement and their privilege. And Smithers is the archetype of all of these. It's a really, really good scene, I think. It seemed to me that maybe that first card game was rational Stephen choosing to use his skill at cards to put down this arrogant idiot who was getting on his nerves and talking about Diana. I think the double or quits, you know, cut gamble shows that actually his blood is up. It's no longer cold, calculating revenge. He's willing to take crazy risks, and he's sort of almost doesn't care anymore, which is a concerning thing if you're on Team Stephen and you have any idea about what could be coming next.
Well, Ian, I don't know about you, but it's really starting to get to be, maybe we should take a little break and go double or nothing for the second half of the chapter when we return.
I'm with you. I've got the deck of cards right here. If you're enjoying the podcast, please come and join our supporters on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/lubbershole. So welcome back. We hope that you managed to calm your nerves during the break there. And remember where we are. Stephen is back aboard the Polycrest, and we had just heard the captain himself was coming back aboard on the port side. So they're back together. And Mike, all the way through the canon, Stephen and Jack reunited has always been a happy place. And at first it seems that way. Jack is delighted to see Stephen, and he says so. He says the ship has been dreary without him. But Stephen has this really strong revulsion, an animal revulsion, when he smells Diana's perfume, as bought for her by Stephen, on the person of Jack Aubrey. Even so, he still feels warmth in his heart for Jack, but he kicks into physician mode. He notices how thin and grey, and he suspects costive or constipated Jack is. He thinks he's dropped another couple of stone, which is 28 pounds for the rest of us. Jack says, well, it's all from not being able to sleep at night. He's been tossing and turning. He has all these ill dreams. He's stupid and ill-tempered every day. And Jack describes how he had caught a glimpse of his face by surprise in the mirror, and he thought he was looking at a stranger with what he calls a damned forbidding ship's corporal's face. Now, the face reminded him of Pigott of the Hermione, which is a very, very unfortunate connection to make. But Jack noticed that he had the same face the following day when he was shaving. So, Mike, Pigott, that's Pigott of the Hermione, right? That was not a happy situation there in the real historical timeline.
No, no, it was not. You know, he's described as the captain of that hell afloat whose crew mutinied and murdered him and almost all of his officers in 1797. That story was told, or if you'd like, will be told in more detail in The Reverse of the Medal. Now, the mutiny, in actual historical mutiny, the last straw was on the Hermione. One of Parker's games of the last man down gets flogged. And in this race to get down, two men fell to their death. And the Captain Pigott ordered, as he said, the lubbers thrown overboard. And that was it. That night, you know, everybody turned on Pigott and almost all of his officers. So, yeah, this is not what we want Jack looking like, given everything we've heard about this ship here. Well, we breathe for a moment. Jack says, I'm so glad you're back. You can give me a draft so I can sleep without all these ill dreams. He said, I had one the other night about your narwhal, and Sophie was somehow mixed up in it, and I woke up blubbering like a child. He reaches back and gives Stephen a long spiraling ivory narwhal's horn. Stephen says, it's perfect, the very apotheosis of a tooth. And Jack says, well, there were longer ones, but their tips were missing, and I thought you would like to get to the point, ha ha ha. And O'Brien writes, it was a flash of his old idiot self, and he wheezed and chuckled for some time, his blue eyes as clear and delighted as they had been long ago, wild glee over an infinitesimal grain of merriment. And I'm thinking, oh, yeah, now we remember who Jack really is, but is not at the moment.
No.
And Jack, who Stephen is. Ah.
Yeah. Now, it's funny. I had forgotten that amongst all the narwhal episodes in the canon, we've got a narwhal right here early in Post-Captain. If you're a narwhal horn enthusiast, you're going to have to wait until Mauritius Command and then the 100 days much later in the canon to get any more narwhal-related satisfaction. So we know it's a piece of natural history that O'Brien was really fascinated by. And of course, in the context of post-captain, it's another bit of phallic imagery to go with all the other phallic images that have been, how can I put this, poking out between the pages of the book here.
If you catch my meaning, right?
Yeah, indeed. So Stephen asks how much he owes him. And this is the moment when he kind of turns out his pockets and all his gold and his coins from the card game with Smithers tip out onto the table. What have you been doing? Asks Jack. Have you taken a treasure ship? Stephen says, no, I have been stripping a self-assertive, worthless fellow, a Jackeen, as he calls him, that had annoyed me, a young snake, a Nagin, the vain, conceited, foolish coxcomb, the lobster. And he's got this, just in typical Stephen style, this long string of epithets for Smithers here. And by the way, Jackeen is an Irish insult that originally was a pejorative aimed at someone from Dublin. And Mike, I think we believe that it might have really first arisen in usage 2 or 3 decades after the timeline that we're talking about here in the canon anyway. But I've heard plenty of Irish people talk about Jackeens, and I know exactly what they mean. Jack says that any card game that involved this amount of money wasn't merely play. This was gaming, high-stakes gaming. And Stephen says, well, Smithers was sweating and concerned about his loss, but he had the appearance of wealth, all its petulant arrogance, certainly. And Jack says, well, Smithers got private means, but this is more than a year's income. You've probably left him very short. To which Stephen says, well, that's fine. I'm glad. That was kind of what I was going for. Please, says Jack, don't do it again. The ship is in a bad enough way without it getting a name for gaming, with all the divisions and jealousy that can come with it. Stephen says, okay, I won't do it again, but Smithers is not getting his money back. And we go back to the topic of how much he owes Jack for the narwhal horn. Please accept it as a present, says Jack. The prize had paid for it. Huh, hold on a second. We have a prize. Well, says Jack, we have taken a small Dutch chaloup. I think that just means a crappy little small boat. A small Dutch chaloup, something they wouldn't have bothered with when they were in the Sophie. Jack had sold his share of the prize money for £75 since he was short, but he doubts Parker would get much more for the share than that. He had hoped that it would be good to give the crew a prize at last, but it didn't do much good. Jack says he already knows that the ship is in a bad way, and meanwhile, Admiral Hart is riding him hard.
It's, I'm thinking this is, you know, this is not going well, but it's not all that bad. And Stephen tries to rescue it a little bit. He tries to change to a happier subject, and he says, well, Jack, show me your honorary sword in the merchant's plate. Sophie told me about him. And Jack cries, Sophie. And he looks like he's been kicked. And then he says, you know, oh, yes. Of course, you called upon her. And I'm thinking, whoa, what is this reaction? You know, what's going on in Jack's mind? Did he think maybe Sophie's near or had been near, or that Stephen's now a rival for Sophie, not just Diana, or is this Jack's own guilt and sense of loss whenever he's reminded of her? Or, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, I forgot. But Jack, now, Stephen meant for this to be a happy moment, but Jack says, you know, I'm sorry, I can't show them to you, Stephen. You know, I pawned them in Dover when I ran short again. Mm. And Stephen hears this in Dover. And Stephen says, you know, Jack, you run an insane risk when you go ashore, particularly in Dover. Dover, of course, being where Diane is. Jack asks, why Dover? Stephen says, it's notorious to your friends, notorious meaning well-known, but also notorious, you know, having a different connotation for us. And if it's notorious to your friends, how much more will it be so to your enemies? If Whitehall knows about it, your creditors will too. Stephen says, now, Jack, don't look so angry. I have to tell you 3 things. You will certainly be arrested for debt if you continue to go ashore. 2, in the service, it's said that you cling to your station, and you know better than I do what harm that's going to do to your career. Jack starts to talk to Stephen and says, no, let me finish. 3, and the text says, have you considered how you exposed Diana Villiers by your very open attentions in circumstances of such known danger? And I think this sets the fuse alight.
I think it does. This is really grim reading. Jack gets very, very formal and very distant. has Diana put herself under your protection? He's asking Stephen. And by the way, there's the flash of that phrase from the dueling code there. Has she therefore asked Stephen to talk to Jack? He demands to know. Stephen says that's not the case. Jack then doesn't really see what right Stephen has to talk to him in this way. And Stephen says, well, I have the right of a friend, don't I? I won't also say duty, for that smells of cant. Jack replies, a friend who wants a clear field, maybe. I may not be very clever, no goddamn Machiavelli, but I believe I know a ruse de guerre when I see one. For a long time, I didn't know what to think about you and Diana Villiers, first one thing and then another, for you are a devilish sly fox and break back upon your line. But now I see the reason for this standing off and on, this not at home, and all this damned unkind treatment, all this cracking up of clever, amusing Stephen Maturin, who understands people and never preaches, whereas I am a heavy-handed fool that understands nothing. And as he's getting higher and higher in the pitch of his anger here, it's noticeable that he's not complaining about Stephen's treatment of him. He's complaining about Diana's treatment of him. It's time, says Jack, that they had a clear explanation about Diana Villiers so that they know where they stand. Stephen says he desires no explanation. And I think this is a moment for another false step by Stephen. He tries to get a bit philosophical here. Explanations are of no use in matters of sexuality where reason flies out the window. And that is the touch paper for Jack. He says, any bastard can cowardly evade the issue by a flood of words. You have said enough, sir, said Stephen, standing up. Too much by far. You must withdraw. I shall not withdraw, cried Jack, very pale. And I will add that when a man comes back from leave as brown as a Gibraltar Jew and says he has had delicate weather in Ireland, he lies. I will stand by that, and I am perfectly willing to give you any satisfaction you may choose to ask for. It is odd enough, said Stephen in a low voice, that our acquaintance should have begun with a challenge and that it should end with one. And Mike, this is a horrible, horrible low point in the book. Yeah, the friendship which has earned and grown so much is in pieces. I think I love how it's written. I love how O'Brien has earned this argument and this falling out. It's made even more serious and grave and heartbreaking by all of the foreshadowing that's come before, all of the misunderstandings, the partial attempts to make amends, the story of the scent. My God, the scent. A lesser author, you might even say even a moderately good author, might have put this kind of breakdown between friends early in the book, chapter 3 or something like that. But this is O'Brien, and it feels like it's almost the end of the book, and that the idea that the friendship has kind of wrecked itself here is just terrible.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, Ian. I mean, this hits me just as hard every time I read and reread it. And you know, I just hate how it's spiraling out of control. And I keep, you know, regardless of how many times I've been through the canon, I just keep thinking, there's nowhere to go from here. This cannot end well. You know, this, I don't foresee this being as, you know, one guy misses and the other shoots in the air or something. This is too intense. Well,
yeah.
Sure enough, Stephen is now meeting with Dundas in a small room at the Rose and Crown and asking him to be his second in the duel. He tells him how he mishandled Dundas's excellent suggestion that he hadn't realized what a state of unhappy passion Jack was in, and it resulted in Jack calling Stephen a coward and a liar. And so I think, as you had said with the code, even Dundas recognizes this. He's horrified. Yeah. And he asks, is there any chance at all of an apology? And Stephen says, well, Captain Aubrey had written to withdraw his use of the word bastard, said he didn't mean it to have a personal bearing or be related to birth, and he's sorry for saying it, but he stands by his other remarks and had written, you know, in his letter, but the gratuitous lie remains. It is not easy of digestion. And you know, I keep thinking to myself, why is Jack making such a big deal of this lie? I mean, you know, did he think Matron had taken Diana somewhere? You know, I'm thinking Jack, he had been seeing Diana the whole time Stephen was gone. But apparently, like you pointed out earlier, he's gotten a lot more not at home and all this other stuff He's now seen a shift in his relationship with Diana and thinks perhaps this is related to Stephen. And she plays up Stephen against him. So she's part of this trouble. Yeah. And of course, Stephen can't go past his cover story for his confidential mission. So it's like, and I think the same way you said, you know, Stephen's blood was up, Jack's blood was up as well, yeah, with his, you know, Pickett-like face. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I think O'Brien has carefully chosen the offense. The offense is lying, or at least the accusation of lying. And if you want to go back to the dueling code, under that code, a blow and a lie, or the accusation of a lie, are the two gravest offenses addressable in a duel between gentlemen. And just like there was the symmetry that Stephen pointed out, the first offense given or received in this relationship in chapter one of Master and Commander was a blow, and this offense is the other gravest offense, a lie, or giving the lie, as it's called. And I think that Stephen in particular and Jack, but a little less so, were kind of primed. Jack, because of his dissatisfaction about his lack of progress with Diana. Stephen, because he's just felt this distance in the relationship building and building and building. And once Jack has pointed out the inconsistency of Stephen's tan and his alleged mission in Ireland, Jack insisted on this, and that neither of them can now back down. It's, you know, like you say, Mike, there's an extra twinge of personal tragedy for Stephen, that it's his work as a spy that means he's trapped in the lie. If he apologizes for it, it looks weak because he can't offer an explanation. If he explains it, then he discloses his identity and his work in intelligence, and that's anathema as well.
Dundas says they're going to have to fit the duel in between missions. He's seen it, you know, happen before, where they had to wait months to arrange a time that works on land. He feels horribly responsible if something were to happen to Matron, since Jack, he knows, is an old hand at duels. And Stephen says, basically, don't worry, I can take care of myself.
Yeah, as we know. So Dundas goes straight to Jack in the character of being Stephen's second here to make the arrangements. But at that moment, the Polycrest is ordered to sea with a couple of storeships. And through the ship now, the news of the end of the intimacy between the Doctor and the Captain makes its way. Although people don't immediately realize the extent and the deadly nature of this disagreement, it's clear that there has been a parting. Stephen watches the reactions of the crew, and he realizes how much of the respect that people had paid him was in fact a reflection of the great man's power. Parker drew away. He reveres authority to an extent much greater than his personal dislike for Aubrey. Smithers doesn't conceal his animosity towards Stephen. I guess no surprise there. Pullings is very kind in the gunroom, but Pullings owes everything to Jack, so he's shy of Stephen when they're on deck. And O'Brien makes the comparison between this and the bizarre life of a bride and a bridegroom. In the same way, the principals in a duel are not supposed to see each other before they reach the altar. Most of the old Sophies, people like Joe Place and Barrett Bonden, share the distress of Tom Pullings. They have this kind of anxious restraint, but never any unkindness. And Stephen tries to embarrass them all as little as he can. And Mike, I'm not surprised at all that Stephen's response to a tricky situation is to withdraw from people.
Stephen, you know, in trying to embarrass them all as little as he can, spends most of his time with his patients. And interesting, with the master, Mr. Goodrich, who surprises Stephen by showing him kind of particular consideration and friendliness. And Stephen knows that the master had an excellent career, would have reached a commission rank, if it had not been for his unfortunate battle with the chaplain of the Bellerophon.
Wow.
Well, one day, beating Stephen in chess, the master asks Stephen if he's ever reflected upon the phoenix. And Stephen shares a few facetious words about the price of cinnamon. And the master, you know, says, you know, I know you wouldn't be talking about the bird itself. And he shares his confidential opinion that the phoenix is Halley's Comet or other comets in history.
Huh.
He's written a book that's based upon the reports of comet sightings and corresponding writing about phoenixes, and his calculations of the intervals in between prove that he's right, he says. He adds that astronomers are sadly out because they didn't realize that the ancients used the phoenix as a poetical way to represent a blazing heavenly phenomena. So they're not catching on to the cycles that he's seeing. He says the chaplain on the Bellerophon was such an astronomer and would not be convinced. And the master had ended up stretching him out on deck with a heaving mallet. It ruined the master's career, but he said, I would do it again to that insulting dog. So I think the master's feeling a little bit. He says, you know, I've been on the wrong side of one of these here or on the other side. The master says he intends to publish all of this along with his prediction that if he's right, there'll be another comet in 1805. And well done, Patrick O'Brien. The master is on to something. In December, actually December 9th, 1805, Biela's comet passed by.
That's very cool.
It was first recorded in 1772, but wasn't officially identified as periodic until 1826 by Wilhelm von Biela. Clearly, it should have been named Goodrich's Comet. Nice job, Patrick O'Brien, right?
Very good job. And it's funny, I was reading past that going, yeah, I'm pretty sure Halley's Comet didn't appear in 1805. But of course, Patrick O'Brien has Goodrich having found another real comet that absolutely did appear in 1805. Oh, excellent. Now, it's quite funny and it's quite charming. By the way, we've got people who insist on their position in this book, haven't we? We've got Parker insisting on his discipline. We had MacDonald insisting on the manuscripts of Ossian. We've got Goodrich insisting on his research into the periodicity of comets. And people are insisting about other things as well. As he's in the sick bay, Stephen listens and he realizes that he can understand a conversation that he's listening to between two Marines, two Highlanders, talking slowly and repeatedly to an Irishman in Gaelic. He finds that it actually comes through the clearest when he doesn't try too hard and just listens like he remembers that he did when he was a child and knew the language. They're saying, these guys, that they'll be back in the Downs soon. And as Stephen hears this, he forms the hope that he might get to find Dundas one more time. Because maybe being back in the Downs means this dual thing can happen. Dundas, later then, comes aboard the Polycrest, asks for the doctor and hands him a note so that they can exchange these words without being overheard. He says the duel is set for 6:30 on Saturday in the Downs, in the dunes there. And Dundas is going to take Stephen there. Stephen nods. He asks for a lift ashore so that he can spend time beforehand in Deal. And Dundas says, yes, I have a boat here. So Stephen takes a few minutes to grab some papers that he knows mustn't be seen, gathers up manuscripts and letters that he prizes, and goes with Dundas. Dundas tells Stephen that Jack's second, somebody by the name of Colonel Rankin, who we've never heard of before, is going to arrive Friday night before the duel on Saturday. The duel's going to take place in a spot near the castle that is often used for this purpose. Dundas asks Stephen if he's provided for, which I think we assume means, have you got weapons? Have you got guns? And Stephen says, yes, he thinks so. And cast your mental eyes back in the canon a chapter or two, and you might have an idea of where he's going to get provided from. But anyhow, we're not quite there yet, right, Mike?
Right. Well, Stephen goes back to the Rose and Crown, and he gets a horse, and he rides slowly towards Dover. And while he's riding, he's reflecting, the text says, upon the nature of dunes, the extraordinary loneliness surrounding each man, and on the inadequacy of language. A thought, he thinks, he would have developed to Jack if he had been given the time. I'm thinking, oh, wow. You know, Stephen's thinking in the natural course of things, when I have these thoughts, I want to talk to Jack, and I would be talking to Jack. But in thinking about the inadequacy of language, he looks out over on the water at the Polycrest and thinks, well, you know, the language does allow people to deal with material things like this incredible complexity of ropes and blocks and sails really well, so well that these things and the language can carry people around the world. And he's having this great philosophical moment. I think he's a little bit close and nostalgic about Jack. And he sees the captain's gig pull away and head for Dover. Well, that queers that moment here.
Yeah.
The text says, this is Stephen thinking, knowing them both as I do, he observed, I should be surprised if there were much liking between them. It is a perverse relationship. That, indeed, may be the source of its violence.
Wow. Yeah. It's not a happy time. And it seems like we might be about to hear something arising for Jack, but we spend a bit more time instead with Stephen. Stephen goes to see his patients at the Dover Hospital, including, by the way, MacDonald, who in a half a sentence in the previous chapter we'd heard about getting wounded in his arm. Turns out that the arm has been amputated. The stump, we find out, is healing well. And Stephen is really trying to comfort him. He says, "You'll soon be rivaling Nelson, springing one-handed from ship to ship, happier than the Admiral in that the sword arm is still there, whereas Nelson had lost his sword arm." MacDonald's very happy. He says, "I'm glad that gangrene didn't start." And he wants to thank Stephen, says he owes him a great deal. And they talk a little bit more and then return to the topic of Nelson. Now, MacDonald asks whether Nelson is a hero of Stephen's, and it turns out that this is because he's got some thoughts about Nelson that might not be all that appealing to somebody who's in the Nelson cult in the way that Jack Aubrey is. Stephen says, "I know very little about Nelson other than that he's revered in the service and that Captain Aubrey thinks the world of him." And if you want to dig into the Nelson narrative, and if you'd like to go one layer below the general perception that Nelson was a hero and the greatest seaman who ever lived. He was certainly, by the way, probably the most effective admiral in the history of naval warfare, certainly in the history of British naval warfare. But he was not a perfectly flawless human being. And there's this particular episode that MacDonald tells us about. He says, "Caracciolo sticks in his gullet, as does the general example of Nelson's conduct." And he talks then about how Scottish lowlanders liked to take after their fictional hero, Tom Jones, who used the story of Tom Jones to justify their immoral behavior toward women. And MacDonald thinks the example of real live heroes like Nelson are even worse. And he goes on to recount his list of Nelson's shortcomings. "Whoremongering," he says, "lingering in port, hanging officers who surrender on terms, a pretty example." And then he concludes, going back to the idea of Nelson and women, and says, "I hate women. They're entirely destructive. They drain a man, sap him, take away all his good, none the better for it themselves." After a pause, he says, "Nasty, nasty queens." And besides being a potentially indirect reflection at Diana, or somebody with Diana's characteristics, I think we're also learning something about MacDonald there, but we can go back to that later.
Right.
Tom Jones was famous because he was written about in this book by Tom Fielding as having received from a wealthy and ardent lady £50 for 4 hours of labor. You can guess what kind of labor. Mike, though, this Caracciolo character was a real-world character, much more interesting and a much more nuanced bit of the Nelson story here, I think.
Yeah, and I think, one of the things we love about O'Brien's writing is that there's so much gray. Nobody's a total hero, total villain. It's like humanity, like we were just talking about Nelson. And this is another one. He was a Neapolitan commodore, well known to Nelson. They had served together, who briefly joined a French-inspired rebellion against Britain's ally, King Ferdinand of Naples, the king of the Two Sicilies. Caracciolo, he became an admiral, and he ended up leading the Republic of Naples Navy in the rebellion against the king. And I'll come back to this, but there's a lot of, it's complicated on all sides here. Did he choose to do this? Was he forced to do this? Anyways, while Nelson's out in the bay, with his fleet, the city falls to royalist forces in a surrender. And the terms of the surrender said there'll be no reprisals. You just give up. There's an amnesty. Well, Nelson saw the amnesty as invalid, since the king, whom Nelson had rescued earlier from the city and, taken away so that if the city fell, he wouldn't be harmed, the king had not been part of the negotiations. We also know from other historians that the king's wife had ordered Nelson to say, "I want this guy killed. If you catch him, I want him killed." Well, the commodore and thousands of others are immediately arrested. So forget it, the deal's off. And the Commodore ends up being tried on Nelson's flagship, not by British officers, by a court of Neapolitan officers and nobles. So some of the folks that this Commodore had served with and saw him as turning on were then pronouncing sentence on him. And he was sentenced to hang from the yardarm of his own former pennant ship. And there's all kinds of things about what he had requested. I'd rather be shot than be hung. There's, you know, all kinds of back and forth about, well, at least he wasn't being treated as badly as the people that were being treated back on land that, you know, the deal was off for. But Nelson confirms the sentence, and just like that, within hours, he's dead. His manacled body is tossed into the harbor, but later is buried by some friends ashore after it floats to the surface, all bloated and pretty awful. And on shore, scores, perhaps hundreds of other prisoners are executed by King Ferdinand's supporters, while others are imprisoned for life. So this whole thing, you know, there's a lot of tension. And you know, we've got some social media posts we can make here, as you say, to kind of dig under these histories. There are on all sides of this, there's all these variations on how complicated it is for this very well-revered Italian Commodore Admiral by what was going on then in Italy at that time, by the idea of, do you really get to choose if you're in the French rebellion? A lot of, you know, nobles, I think, found themselves going, okay, you know, it's either lose all your family, lose all your possessions if you don't help out. There may have been some of this going on. Nelson himself, it's been argued, was suffering from some brain injury earlier, was in the midst of some other things, was under immense political pressure. Who knows? So we would highly recommend, if you're really interested, and it's fascinating history, to dig into both this Admiral, Commodore, and Nelson in the period of the time. And we hope some of these links will help you to do that.
Wow. So it's complicated, right? This whole Nelson story. And MacDonald was on top of it. Yeah. So it turns out that Stephen's come to ask MacDonald a favor. And I think lots of us have guessed what the favor is. Stephen wants to borrow those exquisite Joe Manton pistols, dueling pistols, that he had been practicing with in the previous chapter. So long as they are for any purpose other than shooting a Marine officer, says MacDonald, Stephen may have them. And Mike, it's curious that he mentions it in that way. Like maybe he's got an idea that Stephen's going to duel with somebody. Maybe he knows what Stephen's feelings are towards Smithers, and he's worried that Smithers might be the opponent in the duel. Who knows? I think there's a bit of a charming ambiguity there. And now we get back with Stephen again in his kind of first-person world. He rides back in this very sweet autumn evening. He goes past a parson walking with his cat, and he thinks, there are days when one sees as though one had been blind the rest of one's life. Such clarity, perfection in everything, not merely in the extraordinary. One lives in the very present moment, lives intently. There is no urge to be doing. Being is the highest good. And by the way, it sounds like you might have read a bit of Sartre there, but we'll leave that to one side. this kind of pleasing reverie and this perspective doesn't really last very long. He guides the horse into the dunes, saying that in any case, doing of some kind there must be, and he's got to get himself ready for the challenge with Jack. Stephen hobbles the horse, places a handkerchief at the height of a person on the dunes there, and he loads the pistols. What one is bound to do, one usually does with little acknowledged feeling, a vague desperation, no more, he says to himself. As he takes up his dueling stance, we get that cold, dangerous look on his face as his body moves, and O'Brien says it has the easy precision of a machine. He thinks he's never known such consistently accurate weapons as these pistols. He wonders if he can still do James Dillon's old trick, tossing a coin up and shooting it on the top of its rise, between climbing and falling. And Mike, the idea of the coin being between climbing and falling is very beautiful writing. It's agonizing when you think that Stephen might also be thinking about people being somewhere between rising and falling.
Well, Jack, in the meantime, had gone to Dover as we saw his ship leaving, and he had called in vain at Diana's cousin's place where she lives, new place. Now we find him drinking beer in an alehouse near the castle, and O'Brien tells us that he's as low as he's ever been in his life. And you know, his emotions are made worse by the beer that he's had. O'Brien writes, anger and indignation were his only refuge, and although they were foreign to his nature, he was steadily angry and indignant. And he's kind of looking all around in this scene. And at one point, he sees this ensign flirting with what, you know, he calls this flimsy little wench. And he pays his bill to the suspicious inn owner, who wonders about him and his sober men and why he's got this cloak wrapped around his uniform. Why, as a gentleman, he's drinking beer and not wine. Why he's not responding to her advances or her offer of accommodation. And says, you know what, I don't want these poofs in my establishment. So kind of a, you know, an insulting word, kind of, you know, wondering, are these guys gay or what? And, you know, having paid the tab, he gets up, he tells Bondin, go back and wait for me on the boat. And he exits out the back door into an alley filled with whores and soldiers. Some of the whores are fighting and others are whispering, trying to entice them on. So this whole scene is kind of very desolate here.
It really is.
Not looking good. And Jack is thinking to himself, you know, that demure not at home he'd heard earlier in the day suggested to him that Diana really was at home. And sure enough, walking to new place, he spots Diana's bedroom light on. So he walks around behind the house. He uses his cloak to shield him from the glass on top of the inner garden wall and gets over with a really determined run and leap. Now, Fred the Mastiff, the guard dog, comes running but stays quiet because he knows the captain. You know, the captain's been there before. And at the back of the house, Jack climbs up the ropes of an improvised crane, which had been left there by a builder who's replacing roof tiles. Jack climbs past the library, sees Diana's cousin. And when he's just below Diana's window, he hears Canning's great, delighted laugh. And I think he's starting to get an inkling of what's going on here. Well, Jack continues climbing up, sits on the parapet, and looks in. And O'Brien writes, for three deep breaths, he might have burst through. And thinking, oh my gosh, you know, these guys are all loaded to bear. Jack's thinking about busting through the window here. Ouch, I can't imagine how that plays out. But instead, you know, he gets through these three breaths and he sits looking at their expressions in the candlelight. O'Brien writes, their intense life and their unconsciousness of a third person. Then shame, unhappiness, extreme weariness, put out the rest, extinguished it utterly. No rage, no fire, all gone, and nothing to take their place. So I think Jack has reached his absolute low here. Yeah. He moves out of sight, swings into the darkness and down the ropes, and is pursued the entire time, O'Brien tells us, by their intensely amused laughter upstairs. So, you know, I'm wondering now, you know, does Jack realize that it's Canning that's been occupying Diana's time? That's why, you know, she's trying to defer his finding out about Canning by playing up Stephen Matron here. I don't know. Ian, what do you think is going on here?
Well, one thing is clear to me, that whatever the connection is between Diana and Canning, it is not platonic.
Right. Absolutely.
Although O'Brien kind of doesn't go as far as saying they were in bed together enjoying each other's company, I'm very clear that that was what was going on.
Right.
And this is a real blow for Jack. I mean, apart from being a blow to his ego as a man who thinks he can get women, he's learning something new about Diana, that this woman that he thinks he's sort of obliged to in some way is doing her own thing and looking in her own way and in her own different places for love or its equivalent. And this means that him telling himself that he should do the right thing by her is a bit pointless. I think both of those are stronger than in his mind than the idea that, oh, Stephen is less of a rival now. I think Stephen's rivalry is really all about what Stephen feels for Diana, and that's really, really strong. But yeah, it certainly makes it cuts out from under Jack Aubrey all of the things that he might have built up in his head about the rightness or the worthwhileness of him pursuing Diana. So Stephen spends the Friday morning writing and decoding, and he produces some kind of a clear statement about what he knows in the intelligence world. He had decided not to go for his usual laudanum dose. He had, therefore, a night of lucid concentration. He seals his papers in a double cover, addresses them to Captain Dundas, and then turns to his diary. This is perhaps the final detachment, and this is perhaps the only way to live. Free, surprisingly light and well, no diminution of interest, but no commitment. A liberty I have hardly ever known. Life in its purest form, admirable in every way, only for the fact that it is not living as I have ever understood the word. How it changes the nature of time. The minutes and the hours stretch out. There's leisure to see the movement of the present. I shall walk out beyond Walmer Castle by way of the sand dunes. There is a wilderness of time in that arenaceous world. And again, Mike, this is, it's beautiful writing. It's really reflective, immediate, first person, you know, Stephen writing of the finest kind. It's interesting that he's talking about the stillness, the availability of time, a wilderness of time. I'm half reminding myself of the pun about crushing time under the wheels of a coach earlier on with Diana. But here by himself, time seems like it stands still. Arenaceous, I think, refers to things being living or growing in sand. So an arenaceous species is one that is adapted for life in sand. So Stephen is very somber and reflective, but feeling curiously light and free. How is Jack doing, do we think?
Well, you know, Jack, too, is sitting at his writing table, but he doesn't get much done before he's called to the flagship. Looking at Aubrey, Admiral Hart thinks to himself, well, I've worn him down a little. And Hart gives him orders to look into Chaleur. Per Tom Horn and Cannonade.net, this is a fictional port on the coast of France. A lot more on that later. Hart tells Aubrey that two British ships chased a corvette believed to be the Fanchula into that harbor. And it's also believed that there are a number of gunboats and prams preparing to move up the coast. Jack is to take all possible measures, and the Admiral emphasizes, consistent with the safety of your ship, to disable the one and destroy the others. The utmost dispatch is essential. And Jack says, well, just for form's sake, I need to represent that the Polycrest needs to be docked. She is still 23 men short of her complement. She makes 18 inches of water an hour in dead calm, and her leeway renders inshore navigation extremely dangerous. You know, Jack says, you know, I just got to put this on the record. Hart says, that's all stuff. You know, my carpenters tell me the Polycrest can stay out for another month. And then Hart kind of twists the nail or the knife into him. He says, all ships make leeway, including the French, but they are not shy of running in and out of that port. Ooh. Yeah, it's like, you know, you're shy, you're shy, he repeats this. And Jack replies, Tech says, with real indifference, oh, certainly, sir. I spoke, as I say, purely for form's sake. And Hart then is sure that Jack's, you know, I think maybe he's a little surprised that Jack is not pushing back on this. He says, well, I'm sure you'll want your orders in writing. Jack says, no, thanks. I think I can remember them quite easily. I'm thinking this is not the Jack we know. This is not a Jack and Hart interaction here. This is Jack still, I think, stunned from swinging down the ropes there.
Ugh. It's agonizing. Again, he's been sort of put into this paradoxical situation where he's going to either destroy himself or destroy himself.
Right.
Going back then to the Polycrest, Jack wonders whether Hart really understands just how much of a death warrant this is. Because maybe Hart is no seaman and doesn't understand the full extent of the thing he's put before Jack Aubrey and his crew here. Hart, as we say, is not much of a seaman, but he does have many vessels in his fleet that he could assign to navigating the intricate passage of the Ras du Point and the Inner Roads. And Jack decides that it's actually a combination. It's equal parts malice and ignorance from Hart here. Then again, Hart might have expected Jack to contest the order and insist upon a survey and so dish his own career. And Jack thinks that Hart has chosen the moment very well as far as the Polycrest is concerned. And he's thinking to himself, what does this mean? And so I think that Jack is surmising that Hart has chosen a moment where Polycrest can believably be said from somebody's point of view to still be a sound ship and to be able to be sent on a mission. But she's enough of a wreck that there's a pretty good chance that Jack is going to get undone here. But what does it signify? He says to himself as he runs up the side of the ship. And I think he's looking ahead now to the duel and thinking, well, who knows what life or death is going to bring in the coming days. Maybe, as we said right at the beginning, Mike, Jack is thinking that things can't get any worse. Anyhow, he gives the orders for the mission to begin. A gun fires, the Blue Peter breaks out, which is going to summon anybody who's ashore to get back aboard ship. And Stephen and many others like him make their way back from Deal.
Well, on board, Stephen starts to feel O'Brien Wright's 100 minute ties begin to fasten insensibly on him, drawing him back into the role of a responsible naval surgeon committed to complex daily life with 100 other men. The Polycrest gets off prettily for once in her life, and on deck, Stephen notices an odd, sullen, shifty glance from old Place and Lakey. He'd always expected it of Bonded, you know, Bonded being Jack's coxswain, that Bonded would have to kind of stand apart publicly. And he thought, well, Place, might have caught it from his cousin Bonded. But he's surprised by Lakey, who's, you know, he's always a talkative man with an open and cheerful heart. And by the way, whose privates Stephen saved. But I'm wondering myself, you know, perhaps these folks are seeing how really low the captain is and are ascribing perhaps part of the fault to Stephen. I don't know.
Which is grim for Stephen as well, because he's already always cherished, you know, the esteem that the crew have for him.
Right.
Now, in the gunroom dinner, Stephen learns the destination. They're headed for this port, Chaulieu. Smithers gets to bragging about his yacht-owning friends who have invited him there on cruises in the past. The master, on the other hand, Goodridge, is thoughtful and withdrawn, doesn't say anything. Stephen watches Parker, who's listening along and seems to be encouraging Smithers, seems to have a bit of an esteem for Smithers' kind of rank and privilege. And Stephen quietly asks the master then to tell him about this port, this Chaulieu. So the master takes Stephen to his cabin and describes it with all the charts spread out in front of him. There's a precarious maze of sandbanks. There's a tide running very fast around the different points. The tide is also responsible for the silting up of the harbour. And he turns to a bigger map to show Stephen some more of what's going on. The harbour is surrounded on the one side by a pear-shaped island called the Île Saint-Jacques and another headland, also pear-shaped, called Fort Convention or Fort Convention on the other side, less than 2 miles away. And in between them lies the harbour. It has a natural storm shelter. There are some fierce tides that keep the inner and outer roads, the inner and outer routes to the harbour, clear. The French have been working to clear the harbour for several years. They've put this rocky breakwater in. It's a potentially very valuable port for Bonaparte's invasion flotilla. And a dozen of these flat-bottom boats have been built already at Chaulieu. This makes the harbour itself almost useless as a place to offload goods, for example. But French ships can lie snug in the inner road under the guns of Fort Convention or in the outer road under Saint-Jacques unless there's a blow from the northeast. Stephen sees, as he looks at the master's kind of strip charts that he has of views of the coastline from the sea, he sees the work of the French military architect Sébastien Vauban. These forts, one on the Île de la Convention, one on Île Saint-Jacques, similar to each other, hold that thought. Now, thanks to our Twitter follower Nick Jeffrey, we've got some examples of these strip drawings or strip sketches that were used as adjuncts to traditional naval charts. And we'll put them out on our social media. Thanks very much to Nick for answering the call and helping us track some down. Now, there's more to the master's description of this very, very tricky approach and the getaway. The inner road, the inner harbor, as you might say, is half a mile wide and 2 miles long, and it runs up past Fort Convention on the east and is protected by two sandbanks, West Anvil and East Anvil, outside them. And then outside the sandbanks, again, is the outer road, parallel but on the seaward side, sheltered on the east by the island and on the other side by Old Paul's Bank, which is a bank meaning a shallow area. The outer road is a really fine stretch of water. It's twice as big as the inner road. And the master has got an approach plan in his mind. He says they'll have to time their approach to take advantage of tide, and maybe, depending on the wind, they might take the route open to them, come to the harbour mouth and come out again with God's blessing via the Ras du Pont, which is over on the east by Fort de la Convention. Do it all fast enough that that fort doesn't knock their masts away with the 42-pounders. Now, Mike, this is a complicated chart layout that O'Brien's described in words here. None of, as far as we know, none of the authorities on this, Tom Horn on Cannonade.net, Dean King in Harbours and High Seas, nobody's come up with a sketch. We've tried to rationalize it for ourselves also so that we can get ready to figure out what's happening in the action in the next chapter. But we think we've got a handle on it now. Anyhow, if the Polycrest can get in, can disable or damage the Fanchula and make it out through the Ras du Pont, this kind of raceway, this channel near the fort, they're going to have to run the gauntlet of this heavy fire. They'll be chewed to pieces if Polycrest can't do all of this with an element of surprise. And the master underlines this, saying he's left his fair copy of his book on the Phoenixes back home with his wife so that she can take it to press if and when they don't return.
So we wrap up the chapter with Stephen saying, so the tide is all important. The master says, yes, wind and tide and surprise if we can manage it. The tides we can work. I reckon to bring her there with the island bearing due south and the square tower southeast and a half east with the flood, not of tomorrow night, but of the night after. Sunday as ever is. And we must pray for a gentle west or northwest breeze to take us in and out again, maybe. End of chapter 10.
Wow. Mike, this is one of the defining moments in the whole canon. It's a really, really full chapter. Especially because the thing that we've always been able to rely on is the strong tie of friendship between Stephen and Jack. And the humor and the dynamics of that has just been shot to pieces. Maybe there are going to be ship-to-ship actions that will surpass it, maybe even in this book. But in terms of our heroes, this is probably one of the most intense moments in the whole canon.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, Ian. Everything appears to be just completely spiraling out of control. The ship, the crew, Jack, and Stephen's relationship, as you just said. You know, and I remember reading this for the first time. Dylan's death was fresh on my mind. I thought, Patrick O'Brien has real jeopardy in these things. You know, yeah, you just go, sure. You know. And I read this and, I just couldn't see how do you get any good coming out of this? Like you said, it's like, you know, heads you lose, tails you lose. Is it going to be about the Polycrest? Is it going to be the duel? Is it going to be that, you know, this duel is delayed by the Polycrest death sentence? You know, Jack sees it, the master sees it, and I think even at the end, Stephen sees it. So, you know, I got to add that to my spiraling out of control list here.
It's incredible, isn't it? We keep going back then, I think, to the conversation between Stephen and Sophie. Don't be so afraid of being refused. How much less jeopardy there could have been, at least a little, if they had all been able to figure this out and Jack and Stephen didn't end up as pointlessly as love rivals calling each other out for this duel. Get out your phones. Get on a Zoom call and sort this thing out before Stephen gets back to the Polycrest. Ah, God bless the internet.
And
Mike, even though Admiral Hart was tolerating Jack at the beginning of the story with the promise of, you know, a share in prize money, that tolerance is gone. And you can see that Jack is disappointed again coming back from the Baltics with this rather paltry prize. And maybe Hart was setting this up, hoping to provoke Jack into harpooning his own career by refusing this order and sink himself. But this seems to have played out okay for Hart, because even though Jack has sort of spat out the hook that was sat there baited for him. The bait itself is still pretty toxic, right? He's going to be just as happy, I think, to have the French sink Jack for him rather than have Jack sink himself. This all being payback for Jack's connection to Molly Hart, for Jack not earning Hart any prize money. And, you know, it's all looking bleak for Jack. Maybe we spend a moment thinking about Molly Hart. I don't know, whatever happened to her.
Yeah, I just kind of always ask myself, well, what did happen? Why we never hear a word about her again? And she was so much of Master and Commander and Admiral Hart back on the scene, but no word. And you know, maybe one of our listeners can catch me up. Did I miss that somewhere?
Yeah, I don't think so.
She just seems to disappear into the ether here.
Yeah. And meanwhile, there's loads of jeopardy in this action in Chaulier, despite the fact that, as we say, Jack has spat out the hook. We've got, think about this for a minute, two different forts, two different sandbanks, two different anchorages to navigate. We've got a route in and a route out, both full of possibilities for being pounded by the enemy artillery, for running aground, for getting embayed, for getting stuck behind a lee shore, getting tide bound, or any combination of the above. So, like we said at the beginning, Mike, it looks like it couldn't get any worse, except it really can.
Right, right. Yeah. I don't see how the tension and jeopardy can ratchet up any higher, but as you say, clearly they can. Or how in the world we step back from all these precipices. It's like, you know, sort of being on the top of a small tower. Yeah. You got to walk and it's down in every direction. I can't wait to see what Post Captain has in store for us. And personally, my tension's ratcheted up a little bit because I'm in the middle of a move. And I'm kind of wondering when I get back to a recording again, sometime between leaving the farm here on Florida and getting established in the new farm in North Carolina here.
Maybe then, Mike, it's a good thing that next week we're going to take a pause to welcome a special guest. Since we're just at the point in the canon when Stephen Maturin's intelligence role is starting to become clearer, what better time to talk to someone who knows all about naval intelligence? So, we're going to be joined next week as our special guest by Steve Maffeo, author of the book Most Secret and Confidential, Intelligence in the Age of Nelson.
Ian, I'm so looking forward to this.
Yeah, me too. We're looking forward to talking with Steve about the world of naval intelligence, its portrayal in the O'Brien canon, the connection to Lord Nelson, and also a sneaky look ahead at events that are coming up in the closing chapters of Post Captain. Meanwhile, Mike, here's hoping your move goes smoothly.
Yeah. I want to apologize to the listeners in advance if perhaps I have to miss a week or so somewhere in the near future here.
Wow, let's see how it all works out. Mike, in any case, whether it's in 1 week or 2 weeks, what do you say, my friend, to just a little bit more of this fantastic Patrick O'Brien?
With all my heart. And then he reaches back and gives Stephen this long, spiraling ivory nawars. Okay, there you go, Sam. He reaches back and gives Stephen a long, spiraling ivory narwhal's horn. Stephen says, it's perfect. The very apotheosis.